Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
We heard during the jukebox a bit of Home Computer by Kraftwerk, which was released more than 40 years ago, 1981 it was. An age, it's fair to say, obsessed by the technological innovations of the future and what the world might look and sound like. But what do we now, in 2024, think the future sounds like? Well, Futuromania, Electric Dreams, Desiring Machines, and Tomorrow's Music Today is a new book that traces the history of sounds that prefigure pop music's future. Simon Reynolds is the author of Futuromania. He also teaches at the music school in the California Institute of the Arts. He joined me earlier on from his home in Los Angeles, and I began by asking him about where some of the trademark sounds of pop music today come from.
Well, there's a series of sort of sounds where someone's grasped some new potential in technology, going back to the 60s, you know, distortion and fuzz and things like that on guitars. That was a whole new thing. And then you had someone like Jimi Hendrix exploring feedback, and there's a famous story, like he did a radio session on the BBC and recording songs, and after a while the engineer said, "Jimmy, I'm afraid we seem to be getting some feedback and distortion, and we can't get rid of it." They didn't realize, trusty old BBC sound engineers, that he had taken this sort of what was considered a defect or a problem, and he turned it into an aesthetic thing. So, and then you get into the 70s, you have experimenting with synthesizers and sequencing. So you have this sort of very mechanistic yet thrilling kind of, it's almost like the music is playing itself. The machines are taken over. Yeah. So, in my book, Donna Summer, I Feel Love, is sort of this thrillingly machine-like metronomic rhythm that people find absolutely hypnotic to dance to. And then you get into the age of, the 80s and digital music, and you have sampling is, something that we all take for granted, but that was something that was so strange that you could make a record out of other records. And there's a sort of characteristic sound that you get in 80s music and in rave music where people put a sample on a keyboard and play it. So you're sort of instrumentalizing the human voice, making these little riffs and stab patterns out of a vocal sample. So when all these things first happened, it's very surprising, and something that musicians could express new kinds of emotions and feelings with.
The book, it focuses on the 1970s and onwards, and when we look specifically at electronic music, you kind of alluded to it there, when do you identify as the birth of electronic music?
I specifically in the book I'm looking at sort of popular music. So it is really the very end of the 60s, early 70s is when that you start to get people messing with synthesizers. There was a little period when a lot of the Beatles messed around with the Moog synth, the Doors did a bit. There's a whole history of, before that, with avant-garde composers using things like the theremin was used in the 1930s. That's that thing. It's most famous in pop music because it's the whinnying, the kind of whinnying high sound in Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys. Laughable attempt.
Beautiful.
We'll take it.
Yeah, the choirs of angels.
There were people who played it in symphonies. Like there was a woman called Clara Rockmore who was the virtuoso player of the theremin. This is back in the 1930s. In pop music, really, the 70s is, you have the groups like Tangerine Dream who are just playing these droning 20-minute long hypnotic pieces, largely on the synth. And then you have Kraftwerk, who are doing something much more pop in a way, very tuneful, but like with these hypnotic machine rhythms and sort of aimed more at the dance floor increasingly.
Without meaning to out you age-wise, I mean, I think that the 70s is when you probably would have been entering your, you know, developing your taste as an actual human being as opposed to just consuming, you know, whatever was played into your ears. Were you always, from a young age, were you curious about the sounds, these strange sounds that were coming out of the radio that didn't sound quite like a guitar, didn't sound quite like a trumpet? They sounded, did they sound different to you as you were going through your, I suppose, musical adolescence?
Yeah, they were exciting. Yeah, I mean, particularly the one that I really remember is I Feel Love. I probably would have been, this is 1977, so I would have been 14, and in the UK, it was like number one for a month or something, and it was really startling. I mean, I'd heard since before, but this was like the way they were used was like, yeah, it did fit, you know, although it was all human beings behind it, it actually felt like the music was playing itself and the machines had taken over, and that was this sort of illusion created. And then Donna Summer's spacey vocal in it just added to it, you know, this sort of, she sounds all kind of celestial and ethereal singing this hypnotic melody about I Feel Love, you know. But that, I think that was a revolutionary record for a lot of people, and it really influenced dance music, and synth pop people like the Human League were inspired by it, and a lot of rave music and techno and trance, you know, kind of owes everything to
the synth. The synth is such an interesting instrument, isn't it? In that, you know, obviously, it's an instrument in bands, but the synth has also been very influential in creating accidentally whole branches of music.
Yeah, I mean, often there are things in these machines that the, sometimes it's capacities in them that the designers didn't really intend on being used in that way. Like, for instance, with Auto-Tune, they intended it to be like Antares Audio, the company, this guy Andy Hildebrand, who invented it. They intended it to be used in a really subtle way, like they intended to be inconspicuous, like, you know, to correct little bum notes in people singing or in instrumental playing, you know, any kind of little errors of pitch, you could sort of very subtly smooth it away. But they left a sort of a function in it which would instantly retune things to the correct speed rather than gradually, but not correct speed, the correct pitch. And this is the sound that people discovered and used in this very, you know, overtly artificial, weird way that you hear so much in, well, first in on Cher's record, but, you know, in rap in recent years, it's very much like a new language for rapping.
Yeah, and I suppose almost has become an instrument in and of itself. And that's an interesting theme, isn't it? You know, if maybe you want to agree with the premise of this, but if you accept that technology is a thing that evolves to solve problems, do you feel like electronic music perhaps is like a reaction to instrumental virtuosity, you know, and that someone might spend 20 years learning to play the guitar really, really fantastically well and come up with all of these new sounds and textures to how that guitar sounds and the stuff that you can produce with it. Now, anybody can buy a MIDI keyboard, download some software, and all of a sudden, the bounds of what they can do with that noise are almost limitless. It's almost like it's become so easy.
Yeah, I think what it is that then that shifts creativity away from necessarily having to have all those kind of craft skills, and it's more like about if you have a good idea or a clever concept. But I mean, you know, the synths have been used in quite virtuosic ways, and you know, like Stevie Wonder was a pioneer of it, and he played in a very soulful kind of funky way, and someone like Herbie Hancock embraced you know, synths in a big way and played in a very jazzy sort of way. So you can be a tool for people who have a lot of traditional keyboard skills, but it can also, you know, during punk people embraced cheap synths because they were even easier to play than a guitar. Like, you didn't even have to learn it three chords. You just play use one finger to play a melody, and you can get a little drum machine beat and
arpeggiated chord. Yeah.
Yeah, so it sort of was like the ultimate in DIY.
Do you, even philosophically, or you know, as a person who listens to lots of music and writes and thinks about music for a living, do you draw a line, however arbitrary it might be, between music that is created by humans playing instruments versus music that is created by humans using digital software or digital sounds?
I don't really draw a line because I think it's still humans expressing themselves. But one of the things I've noticed with music that is play involves a lot of sequences, like sort of sequenced rhythms and or drum machines, is when you listen to it, you don't have this impulse as a listener to play air guitar or air, you know, with instruments that are like guitars or drums or whatever. Even though you don't know how to play it, there is sort of a physical feeling that you feel that makes you want to imitate. So in my case, I like to imitate instruments, but when it's entirely assembled on a computer, there's no sort of physical actions for you to sort of imitate, you know, and you sort of know that. So I don't think anyone has ever done air sequencer or air, you know, computer program, you know. It's sort of somehow you know that it's not a physical music in the way that you know, playing a saxophone is.
I find that absolutely fascinating because, and I mean, you've written extensively about the punk and post-punk kind of era where instruments were crucial, both as a means to achieve sound, but also as a symbol. You know, you've got Hendrix, the symbol of Hendrix burning his guitar, or I think it's Paul Simonon, isn't it, and smashing his guitar on the cover of London Calling, the Who doing the Who stuff. Do you think that we lose anything, however intangible it might be, by the increased digitization of music in terms of symbols?
I don't know. I mean, I think, well, for some reason, your story about the smashing of the guitar reminded me of this story about the Human League, where they actually, when they first played, they had to put up protective things for their synthesizers because people would throw beer at them and they didn't want their synthesizers to explode. But that's a tangent. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that. I think, yeah, I mean, a lot of electronic music, there aren't really performance symbols that go with it, you know, like the way a guitarist brandishes the guitar. You know, a lot of electronic music, it's really interesting to listen to, but not necessarily to go and see someone. You
To
might
watch,
see like a guy with a laptop, you know, and the glow of the laptop screen on their face, but they're moving their hands around, you know, using a mouse, you know, or something like that. So it's not really, it's not as exciting to look at. It doesn't have that performance gestural language that, you know, is intoxicating about rock
Maybe
bands.
maybe it's intended to hit something a bit more primal in us, because I think of electronic music as very sexy, or at least very closely associated with sort of sex and moving your body and dancing and kind of base level human emotions. Maybe it less of music as a performance and more of music as kind of a driver of more animalistic stuff. Maybe that says more about me than about music, though.
No, I think you're right because certainly disco had that connection with, you know, the 70s permissive society, and you know, a lot of it was kind of all, you know, audio erotica, and discotheques were places where people went to cop off with each other or find a partner. And I think that, you know, and even the radio was less about that, but it was still about this primal thing of dancing. I think, you know, the human energy part of it is less in the sight of the musicians playing it and more in what happens on the dance floor, which includes the kind of sexy vibes you're talking about, but also just the ritual celebration of people, you know, losing it to a great beat.
If we look forward to today, well, not forward to today, if we look at today and the influence on technology on the music that we listen to now, it is it must be quite unbelievable. You know, we were talking earlier about how you sort of started to you developed your own taste in music in sort of the 1970s. Even over those 4.5, 5 decades, the leaps and bounds that technology has taken in the realm of music and sound, absolutely staggering.
Yeah, I mean, it is amazing. And now with, you know, people are trying to find creative uses of AI. There's a lot of people doing just sort of very uncreative things with it, like just sort of creating kind of mashups and pastiches, and fake Oasis songs or fake songs by the rapper Playboi Carti. But there are interesting musicians like Patton and Holly Herndon who are trying to sort of use it as a really expressive, creative tool and making kind of very weird but strangely emotional kind of music using AI. So that's something I never dreamt I'd see in my lifetime. And it was really interesting to see in the next few years where that goes and whether it really becomes something where you can actually hear the sort of distinctive sound of AI.
Well, how do you feel about that, the idea of AI-generated songs? Because I know what you mean. You sounded a bit dismissive then, and I don't know if you've used any of the AI song generator prompts where you chuck in a prompt and then it comes up with a song in like 30 seconds. And I mean, it's pretty amazing, but it's not very good. There was a song that some music producer did that was like a Drake and The Weeknd kind of mashup song, and it wasn't especially original, but it really did sound like them, and I thought it was quite a cool song, actually. How do you feel about AI and the way that technology is headed and how music will be affected by it?
Well, I think the thing of doing imitation of existing things is not very interesting. It's what's really interesting is if people come up with stuff where it's like some unimaginable hybrid or missing link between two very different artists. When the artist who is using the AI has some kind of real agenda or vision they're pursuing using it as a tool. But because we have this culture of memes and quick throwaway ephemeral kind of stuff that goes on TikTok, the huge preponderance of stuff that's being generated by AI seems to be kind of versions of things that already exist. We already have enough work by Drake. I think he's very prolific, so having AI versions of Drake doesn't seem like adding much to the world. But I think that's often been the case with new technology. You get a glut. You get a glut of stuff, and then there are these people who are probably the people who'd always be, whatever era they were in, they'd always be the interesting ones. They find the new really interesting.
It's interesting to hear you mention TikTok and sort of memification because, a lot of people talk about the idea of the death of the album, that people don't have, well, perhaps that music is so easy to access now that, the market demands songs and therefore musicians provide songs as opposed to contiguous albums, that flow from song to song to song and that might take an hour to take in fully. Do you think that, with, as you say, the preponderance of music on TikTok and TikTok in terms of directing people's tastes, might we be staring down the barrel of the death of the song in favor of the rise of, I don't know, the riff, the sample, the chorus, the whistleable thing that is designed not to be listened to but to accompany a short video clip?
Does seem that it's going that way. There is a kind of, I don't know if the word is molecularization, but a miniaturization of attention spans and what's considered, a unit of entertainment. And a lot of these clips are like 15 seconds, 30 seconds long, and the music is tailored to go in these sort of bursts, like these sort of dopamine bursts that people are pursuing. So yeah, it is a bit worrying. I think you get people who are going the opposite way and putting out like double albums of stuff and sort of sequencing them so they work as a whole. But I think from what I gather, a lot of people, even when the artist has carefully sequenced and done a coherent album, they just put it into shuffle mode and sort of turn it into just stuff they have, their own kind of background sound. So yeah, it's a little bit worrying. A bit concerning.
Simon Reynolds, it's been really great and interesting chatting to you this evening. Thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Lovely to be on the show.
That was Simon Reynolds, British music journalist based in LA. The book is called Futuromania, Electric Dreams, Desiring Machines, and Tomorrow's Music Today.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.